Session number 12319, Mr. Alfred Card, Part 1.
Please could you tell me how and when you came to be in the RAF?
Yes, I joined the RAF in March 1939. I was working at a hat works in Stockport, and I couldn't see much advantage in staying there, just a menial job. And I'd always wanted to join the RAF since I more or less left school. And 1938, I decided to apply, and I started training in March 1939 at RAF Uxbridge.
Did you want to be a pilot?
Yes, I wanted to fly, but I did not have the necessary medical, educational qualifications to be a pilot, in that I was not educationally up to standard.
What was your training like at Uxbridge?
Very strict, very stiff, but I enjoyed it. It was something completely new to me. I had to adapt to discipline, but being a young lad, I was only 17 and a half at the time, I enjoyed it. And it was just the usual basic training of marching, drilling. And we used to have one period that used to call aircraft handling, which is the nearest I ever got to an aeroplane for quite some time. And this was an aircraft, the fuselage of an aircraft, in an old MT shed. And we used to go along, and they showed us how to start it up. And it frightened the living daylights out of me, because I'd be petrified at trying to get hold of the propeller and swing it round. And
because of the danger.
Well, yes, that's right, yes. And I was not what you might term mechanically minded, anyway. But that was, you know, the sort of nearest we ever got at an aeroplane for the first, 12 weeks, I think, of training.
How did you come in to be in the parachute side of it?
Well, really, when I left the recruits training, I went to RAF Feltwell as an aircraft hand general duties. That meant at that time, general dog's body, you did all sorts of jobs. And I worked in a cookhouse. I was a fireman. I was on the police section. And then in about 1941 or thereabouts, I got posted to a balloon squadron in Cardiff. Again, doing general duties as aircraftman. But when I was there, I eventually was sort of raised to the rank of leading aircraftman, and I was sent on a course to RAF St Hatton, which is the RAF PT school, to do a bayonet fighting instructor's course. When I was there, they said, "Would you like to be? How many of you would like to be physical training instructors?" As they were trying to recruit more instructors. So I thought, well, promotion it, I'd be made a corporal, so I volunteered for that. But at that time, my mother was very ill, and the flight sergeant in charge of where I was working in the balloon squadron suggested that I apply for compassionate posting near Stockport, and I did. They posted me to Wimslow. I've been at Wimslow about 6 weeks, 7 weeks, when my posting came through to go to RAF Loughborough for a course in PT. So I did a course there, I think it was of 6 weeks, where I did 2 weeks of drill instruction, 4 weeks of PT as a PTI to learn how to be instruct people in PT, and promoted to corporal PTI and sent back to Wimslow. Then in the way of the RAF, they decided to change the style of PT. They brought in more combative, more toughening exercises. So all PTIs had to go on a course to learn how to throw logs about and do unarmed combat. We went to Cosford. Now, at Wimslow, not far from Wimslow, was a place called Ringway, which I knew they were parachuting. But we never saw much of them. It was a sort of a hush-hush thing. And the nearest I saw of a parachutist was when I was on an athletics meeting at one of the local schools, and we had this paratrooper running, and he was a sergeant parachutist, And at that time, we thought these parachutists were all he-men. They could drive cars, they could fire every gun there was, and he looked as sort of a Superman. This was the sort of story that was given out. So, you know, something of a bit of awe of this fella. Anyway, I went on this PT course, a refresher course, for a fortnight, and when I was there, they said, hands up, all those of you would like to be parachute jumping instructors. So I thought, oh, I'm not going to be able to fly as a pilot or anything like that. I was a gunner. Perhaps I'll be able to do this. So I volunteered. So they said, okay, those of you that want to do it, climb up to that high board and jump off. Anywhere you want. We just want to see whether you've got courage enough to jump off a high board. Well, I went up this high board. I'd never dived off anything like this before because, you know, I was petrified. So I just sort of closed my eyes, held my nose and jumped. And they said, very good, very good. We'll put your name down. And that was my sort of test as to whether I would be fit enough to be a PGI. Anyway, about a month, 2 months after that, this is in 1942, about 2 months after that, the posting came through to report to RAF Ringway for training as a parachute jumping instructor. So that was in July 1942. And I went over there. I was rather young. I was aged, at the time, 20. And they were in two minds as to whether to take me on because I was rather young, they said. They didn't think I could sort of would be able to train paratroops. Never mind, nevertheless, I started the course and we did our first jump on my first parachute descent was done on the 5th of July 1942 from a balloon one Sunday morning at Ringway. Now, I'd never flown an aeroplane. The closest I'd been to an aeroplane at that point was when I was doing guard duty as an airman. So can you imagine what it's like being faced with a balloon and with the knowledge that I had to jump from it. The night before, I think we were all in our, some of them went out, but I stayed in and we sort of chatted and talked about it. And I think we all had the feeling of perhaps the condemned man might get. The night before, he goes for the final drop. Next morning, when we drew our parachutes and went out, and the normal thing was with the instructors, the instructor used to take their trainees out, and they would all sing songs, or the instructor would tell them some joke, or anything to keep the spirits up. And then when we got out to Tatton Park, we'd drawn our parachutes, and then normally the instructors, trainee instructors, we had to wait until everybody else had done their jumps. So then we would put in on the end as a sort of a stopgap, if you like. And our instructors, well, all instructors, we used to say to them, and our instructor was the same, a chap called Taff Evans, and he was a small little Welshman, very cheerful, very good instructor. And he said to us, as we all did, right, who wants to go first? So I thought, well, if you do it first, it's over with. You haven't got to wait and watch all the others. So I volunteered to go first. And a friend of mine who had been on a PT course with me volunteered to go second, follow me. He was with me, like friendly with me, so we sort of went together. And there was four of us in the cage. But the last moment, instead of our instructor coming to dispatch us, we had an officer who was training to be an instructor to come up to dispatch us. And I think we were the first trainees he dispatched. Now this, funnily enough, all trainees, they build up a sense of confidence with the instructor. For some reason or other, the instructor imparts so much confidence in with them that when they change the instructor over the last moment, that confidence goes. You don't feel quite as happy about it for some reason. I mean, once you get up there at the edge of the door or whatever, no one can help you. You're on your own. So, I mean, despite what the instructor said, he can't do much for you once you've left. But the point is, they teach you so much And I say, you build up this confidence. And at the last moment, there was sort of changed. Another instructor, it knocks the confidence out a little bit. Now, I'm not excusing that for my what happened, but that it happens. We're using a balloon, which is a normal type of Barnard balloon, slightly larger, to take a cage underneath with five men in, four people jumping and one instructor. And we had a hole, we used to jump from a hole in the centre. And the idea was we sat on the edge of this aperture with the feet and knees together. We shuffled as close to the edge as we possibly could. The instructor would call out to us, action stations. And when he yelled out, go, we then push with the hands, put the feet and knees together, arch the back and drop straight through. Well, on the way up there, what we had to do was sort of sit back, hold on to two handles. And this is what I did. I sat well back. I didn't dare look at the ground. I kept looking up at the balloon all above me all the time. And the instructor was trying to tell us some joke, which I hadn't foggiest about, but turned out to be something about angels at the gates of heaven, which wasn't very, very appropriate, really. Anyway, the thing was deathly quiet, and it suddenly stopped. And you could hear the sort of little bit of wind blowing through the cables. And then he was looking over the side, because to make certain, you see, with the balloon cage, problem is, the balloon is at the end of a cable, and there has to be a slight angle on the cable. Normally it happens because the wind just blows it back slightly. So you've got a slight angle. But you had another instructor down the bottom who had to sort of signal to the instructor at the top to let him know when to jump. So he did this in Aldous lamp. So when he looked down and he saw the green Aldous lamp, said, OK, action station, number one. I thought, that's me. So I shuffled as close to the edge as I could, sat there, and then he said, go. So I sort of feebly left the side. I must have made a horrible yell and screamed like mad, made one wild grab for the other side and missed, and plummeted down. And suddenly there was this rustling and flapping, and I looked up, and there was a lovely yellow parachute floating above. And I looked down, and there was the ground way below me, and I could hear my instructor, flapped out at Murphy, yelling, spider! Because my arms and legs had been all over the place. But I couldn't care less. I was floating down, and lovely, and happy, and you got a marvellous feeling on that jump, because before it, you're petrified, you're absolutely frightened. As one friend of mine said when they asked him, they said, do you get butterflies in your stomach? He said, butterflies? No, he said, dirty great big eagles. Anyway, when I landed, it was lovely. I rolled the parachute up, ran over to him, and he said, now then, Corporal, that was a bad thing, wasn't it? You came out all legs, arms and legs. You'll have to do better next time. Sort of fine up. And as I ran off, he said, not bad, lad, not bad. Well, we were able to jump then. The next day we went off on air experience, and then we didn't jump until about 4 days later because the weather was bad. And then we did our first aircraft descent.
We're talking about July 42.
42, right? Yeah. And then in the first aircraft descent from a Whitley aircraft, which was a converted bomber, I'm used to exit through the hole. Now, when they first started parachuting, before I got to Ringway, they used to jump, they had no real static line parachute. The parachutes were a manual operated parachutes that were adapted. And one of the first things they used to do, first jumps they used to do, was they removed the gun turret from the rear of the Whitley and built a platform there with a handle on. You used to stand the parachutist on the back of that, and they did what they called pull-offs. What he used to do, they would stand and face forward, and the instructor would stand just in front of him. And when the instructor gave him the word action station and go, and the man pulled the ripcord, and the parachute came out, and pulled him off the aeroplane. He used to do this before the war at Hendon, a lot of the Hendon air displays. He used to climb on the wings, do the same thing. Well, the story goes that one day there was a gentleman there, a warrant officer, and he was being dispatched by an RAF flight sergeant, and they were flying over towards Tatton Park, flying over Altrincham, as they were running in, this flight sergeant said to him, now, Johnny, you know what to do, don't you? When I give you the word, and Johnny said, yes, this, grab the ripcord and pulls it, and away he goes. Snag was is about 5 miles away from Tatton Park, and felt landed in someone's garden just outside Altrincham. She had a long walk back. But eventually they got rid of that idea because it wasn't very much good. And someone had the bright idea of removing the turret, the dustbin that used to be in the Whitley, taking that out, building the aperture up that was left, and jumping from that. This brought in the problems of the parachutes, because they could not use manual operated parachutes, so they devised a static form of opening, which went very well until one soldier unfortunately somersaulted as he went out, wrapped himself round his parachute, and as we never used reserve parachutes, then he lost his life. I think he was one of the first people to lose his life parachuting at Ringway. And what they did then was they designed a special type of parachute to be used by the paratroops. It was designed by a gentleman named Sir Raymond Quilter, the Quilter Aircraft, Quilter Parachute Factory at Woking. He designed this parachute, and what it basically was, the difference between that and the manual operated chute was this. When the ripcord of a manual operated chute is pulled, this pulls out a couple of pins holding the pack in, an extractor parachute, which is attached to the main parachute, pulls out, pulls the main canopy out, and the man falls from that, and the parachute opens and comes down. You get considerable jerk from that. The static line parachute, what has happened, the parachute is packed into a bag. The rigging lines were stowed on a flap, which is then rolled up. On the edge of the bag is a long line with a D-ring on, which is fastened to a hook inside the aeroplane. It's all worked out so that the parachute would be clear of the aeroplane. It was roughly a static line about 12 feet long, and the static line, the strop inside the aeroplane, was about another 12 feet. So that gave us about 20 foot clearance underneath, so the parachute would not foul the aeroplane. To make certain that the parachute came out in sequence, had a series of ties. The lift webs were tied in, the rigging lines were rolled up, and then they had what they call a central base tie that allowed the rigging line to develop before the canopy was pulled out. And then the final tie at the apex, the rather top, when that broke, then the thing dropped down and inflated, and the man came down. In all, it took about, 2 seconds, thereabouts, 1.5, 2 seconds, I can't remember now exactly. But there was very little shock of opening because it was pulled out behind him, a nice steady opening. And that worked well until they had another problem developed. By rolling the rigging lines up and stuffing the two lift webs in the side of the parachute, on one occasion, one of the D-rings came down, crossed over the lines, and because there was a bolt sticking out, caught a line, pulled all that line out, and that caused a malfunction of the parachute, and the chap was unfortunately killed. That meant they went back to the drawing board, altered the design of the parachute, and that way they gradually altered the design of the chute. So the design today, I think, is basically the same as it was. They've got slightly different parachutes. But in those days, we used what we called a 28-foot parachute, which gave a flying diameter of somewhere in the region of, as near as I can remember back now, somewhere in the region of about 24 feet, thereabouts. It was bigger than the parachute used by the aircrew, which was a 24-footer. It was bigger by virtue of the fact that the paratrooper, it was envisaged, would be carrying equipment with him, like a rifle or a machine gun. So they had a slightly bigger parachute, it gave him a slight landing. But the thing is, it's quite interesting, really, the difference in weights with the parachute. It's not a great deal. We had a chap there called Sunderland, who was a warrant officer in charge, and he used to tell the story about the officer who came up to him one day, who was rather weighty. The maximum weight we used to like people to have was just about 13 stone. This chap was over 13 stone, but he conned someone into doing the course anyway. And he'd found out that Mr. Sunderland had some parachutes which were larger than 28 foot, were 30 foot. And Joe used to say that he used one of these himself. So we saw Mr. Sunderland and said, could I use one of your 30 footers? And Joe said, certainly. So Joe goes round to get one of these parachutes and realises there were none packed, as there were only a few of them. So he very quickly got a piece of chalk out, wrote on the side of one parachute, 30 foot, and gave it to him. It was a normal 28 foot parachute, but he gave it to this chap. This chap jumped with it, came back, handed over to him, and said, you know, Mr. Sunderland, that's the best jump I've had, he said. Amazing the amount of difference that extra 2 feet makes, isn't it? The same parachute, no difference at all. So just a lot of confidence. And that was the whole aim, really, of a lot of parachute instructors, of the parachute school in those days, because, I mean, let's face it, you're going to do a parachute descent, you've never been near an aeroplane in your life before, seen fly one over, and some idiot like me turns around to you and says, right, you're going to do a jump this morning, we've told you what to do, you've been training on the ground for a week, and you know how to jump out of an aeroplane, how to handle a parachute, how to land, now you're going to jump from that balloon. And while you're drinking your cup of tea, you look across, as actually happened, and you see one come out, and his parachute looks very, very funny. And when your instructor comes out to you, you say, excuse me, staff, but that second chap, what happened to his parachute? And the instructor said, nothing to worry about. A slight malfunction now. We used to get what are called thrown lines, where the line appeared to go over the top of the canopy. There was no problem with those, because the chap used to get a softer landing, to land okay. A lot of people had them. But the instructor knew that that was not one of those. He knew that that parachute had not worked properly and that man was very likely, as it turned out to be, was dead. So how do you convince people that what they've just seen is a failure of a parachute that they're going to use and being convinced it's going to work? So the instructors developed the knack of lying, if you like, or building up confidence. So much so that when you march them out, I marched a group of bloke out, and we passed a poor unfortunate that had been killed with a parachute failure. And they used to take the body away for the medical chap to try and see what they could do, but cover the parachute over to see what had gone wrong with the parachute. We had to cover it over so we could have a look at it and see what caused it. And we passed it. One of the lads said to me, What's wrong with that chute there then? I said, oh, they're just making certain that parachute's all right. We can look at it. So what happened to the chap? I said, he's all right. He's just gone off to hospital. I think he'd be okay. Get them in the cage, and they jumped out, and they all jumped out all right. At the end of the course, one of the chaps came up to me and said, you're a bloody liar, aren't you? You knew that chap had been killed. I said, yeah, but I wasn't going to tell you, was I? Well, this was it, you see, and we had to sort of build this up. And another, a further thing was, you see, I was just 20, and one chap said to me, he said, how old are you? I said, I'm 20. He said, I never thought a young kid like you, he said, could get me to jump out of an aeroplane. He was all of 30 or something like that. But another thing on this, you see, the instructors were supposed to have done 20 parachute descents before they were taken on the staff. When they did that, we got an extra, I think it was shilling a day, and we also got a little badge to wear on the arm, a laurel wreath with a parachute in the middle. But the fact was, most of us had never done more than 10 or 15 jumps. We had to sort of keep up the charade of being experts when we were a little better than the people who were training, because we didn't know a great deal more about it. Very few people did. I mean, parachute training then was really in its infancy. And we had to sort of build up a training schedule at the same time as we were training these people. And I did about a month's course, and then I was made up to sergeant. I'd done about some in the region of 10 descents, 6 from an aircraft and 4 from a balloon. And there I was training these people and telling them how what easy it was to jump out of aeroplanes. And if they did exactly as I told them, they'd be okay. They would get up and walk away all in one piece. And it used to be the thing at that time, when we used to take our people out to Tatton Park in a coach, and as I say, we'd sing them songs and tell them stories and things like cheer them up, come back, give them more ground training, and then take them, drop them from the aircraft, because these are two balloons, and at that time, five aircraft descents, which is seven descents altogether. And then they got their wings. And as I said, some of them, on some occasion, were walking away with more parachute descents than what the instructor that trained them had. Because our job was to teach them to parachute. We all jumped ourselves, but at that time, one of the men with the highest total of jumps was a chap named Flapjack Agate, Charlie Agate, who was the officer in charge of the dropping zone at Tatton Park. He was considered mad because he was jumping, or as he used to call it, fiddling. He was a fiddler parachute. If you put a parachute down, turn around to pick it up, it was gone. Charlie had pinched it to go and do a parachute descent with it. And he'd done, at about the end of 1942, somewhere in the region of 100 parachute descents. Well, there are people now who are talking about doing 2,000 and 3,000, and they were parachuting nowhere near as long as in length of time. I mean, they've done that in a comparatively short time compared to the fact that it took me something like 2.5 to 3 years to do 100 parachute descents. Because our main job was teaching people to parachute. And the three elements, really, of a parachute descent are the exit from the aircraft, the flight on the way down, and the landing. Now, the main thing with the exit was that we should teach people to jump out with the feet and knees tight, in a position of attention. And as soon as the parachute developed, as soon as they left the airplane, they'll look up and watch the parachute develop. And as soon as it developed, then they adopted what we call the parachuting position, which meant they had to sort of sit in the approved position with the feet dangling below them, feet and knees tight together, hands on the lift webs, and wait for the ground coming up towards them, and then they would hit the ground and roll over in the manner in which we taught them. Which was, in the first days, purely and simply, the forward roll that people were taught in the gymnasium. Most people had done it, where they hit the ground, punch forward again and roll over. But we had to teach them a different technique, which was to hit the ground with the feet, fall onto the side of the leg, and then let the roll along the back, and tuck the head in, and fall up in a little ball. And to do that, we had to take them on various pieces of equipment, which had been devised by the instructors. The flight technique was taught in a swing, just like an ordinary kiddie swing on a larger scale. But in up to 1943, from 1941 to 1943, there was very little in the way of flight technique, in that when the parachute developed, it invariably had what we call oscillation, where it swung backward and forward, caused by the air inside the canopy trying to escape. And it lifted up the canopy and caused a swinging motion. And the only thing we could do with that, we used to teach them how to turn in the harness. So that a chap was, instead of facing...